Ars Electronica 2008. A new cultural economy.
So we are happy to have Wendy Hui Chung here from Providence Brown University, where she is associate professor of modern culture and media. And she is working in two fields, which she has also both been studying, because she has a degree in systems design engineering and in English literature. And she's combining these two fields and mutuates them in her current work on digital media. Her most important books are Control and Freedom, Power and Paranoia in the Age of Fiber Optics, published with MIT Press in 2006, and co-editor of the History and Theory Reader on New Media, Old Media, and forthcoming is a book, Programmed Vision, Software, DNA and Race. So I must admit that almost already in 2006 we wanted to invite you, but we discovered you a little bit too late for this conference on cybernetics, because you have been working in this field too. So we are even luckier to have you here now on under a little bit different topic this time in Linz. Okay, thanks.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and I'd like to thank Katya for inviting me here today. It's a real pleasure to be here and talk about interactivity, because it's also a time for me to reflect or interact with some of my older arguments and to think through them. So today I'll be thinking through and going through some of the arguments I made in my first book, Control and Freedom, Power and Paranoia in the Age of Fiber Optics, but I'll be doing so while rethinking what's been happening with Web 2.0 and some of the newer new media movements. So my driving question is what all of our driving questions is today, which is what does interactivity really mean? Why has interactivity, which has been linked historically in computer science to making machines, not humans, more active, it's been linked intimately to the emergence of artificial intelligence. Given this, why perhaps perversely has interactivity been linked with the notion of user empowerment? Of user freedom. What happens when you take this vexed relationship between interactivity and empowerment, control and freedom seriously? That is, what happens when you treat the interface not as a one-way street, but rather as a two-way window, and a two-way continuous window? And lastly, the question I want to ask is, what if the experience of user empowerment, or what if, more importantly, the experience of freedom, the experience of democracy that the internet is supposed to be all about, isn't linked to what we normally consider to be user empowerment, but rather intrusion? What if we take interactivity, which means reciprocal action, seriously, right? So that what makes something freeing is not that it allows us to look out, but rather that it allows others to look in. In other words, it makes us insecure rather than secure. Okay, so the lecture talk today is divided into two sections, sniffing and stumbling, and part two, pornographic intrusion. So to begin. Sniffing and stumbling. I'll be stumbling as I speak, too, because I haven't slept. I flew from Boston yesterday because I had to teach, and so it'll be appropriate. So the internet in the mid to late 1990s was sold as an interactive medium of freedom, an interactive medium of democracy, an interactive medium of the future, right? So it allegedly broke down the social and technological barriers by allowing everybody to post. It allegedly established a worldwide marketplace of ideas and commodities, and it allegedly broke with the past, right, where in the past the future plus technology equaled dystopia, equaled a nuclear winter, and offered us a window to a brighter future, a more utopian future. That this rhetoric is still with us is clear from the hype around Web 2.0. And importantly, Barack Obama, in order to mark his distance from John McCain, in order to mark change, sent his VP choice via text message and email to everybody. So it marked a difference. This, of course, meant that everyone sent fake text messages and email addresses, right, saying who the VP would be. But regardless, he said, so Time magazine declared you person of the year. And the magazine article covers there. And what's great about that is that you see that the front is actually a mirror, right? So you're supposed to see a picture of yourself. So you sat before the screen, control the world. Your representations behind the screen populate the world. This control, this interactivity, this freedom allegedly marks the difference between the televisual and the computer window, right? Both of which it's claimed divide the public from the private. So if the mass media has reduced individual citizens to listeners rather than speakers, to couch potatoes rather than Martin Luther's, the internet allegedly allows individual citizens to once again publish their views as scholars before the literary world. This is enlightenment. Also, this is because whereas television induces zoning out and passivity, the internet allegedly demands active mouse-clicking and literacy, right? By clicking a mouse, you're doing something fundamentally different than clicking a TV remote. This is some form of interactivity. However, as the critique of Barack Obama as a celebrity and merely a celebrity also makes clear, this democratization has also been linked to the normalization, it's alleged, of a certain celebrity culture, of a certain type of exhibitionism. Indeed, it's been alleged that what the internet has done is move exhibitionism from a private pathology to an everyday experience. So for instance, you have sites like Twitter in which people can list everything they're doing and where they are at all times. And here you see the Twitter site of one of my really fabulous grad students. And I know what she's doing every minute of the day. As well, you have, that's too much information. I think she wants me to read her work. This is why she does it. As well, you have Anacam, right? And these websites is offering 24/7 access to people. At the same time, however, and importantly, control has been used to describe the internet in a very different manner, right? So the internet has also been discussed as a mass medium of control. The internet is allegedly part of Echelon, right? This mass surveillance network stemming from the Cold War that registers all email messages and cell phone conversations. And it's not just state surveillance, but also commercial surveillance as well, right? So Google stores every search you make and links it to an IP address, which is why people have been calling Google the Stasi resource of the 21st century. And it's not just commercial, but it's also personal. So think again of these webcams, etc. So the pathology the internet normalized would thus not seem to be exhibitionism, but rather voyeurism, right? So which is it? Control or freedom, voyeurism, or exhibitionism? Now what's intriguing is what's often brought up as examples of one, examples of exhibitionism, are also brought up as examples of the other, voyeurism, right? Think of the webcams. Now, it's not just personal sites, but also sites that allegedly address pressing societal issues. And in order for us to sort of grasp the worldwide nature of the World Wide Web, let me show you the Hong Kong bus uncle clip. So this clip was extremely popular in Hong Kong, and through it, the English translation as well. And for a while, if you searched on Hong Kong on YouTube, this is what you would get. So. Can we get Sam?
你做咩唔好意思啊？我係講啱明定啱？你講啊！你想攞台咧，唔好意思啊，老闆。我唔係攞台。你想攞台咧，唔好意思啊，老闆。我唔係攞台。你而家你講電話，我冇出聲。你做咩要話大聲？我好唔得啦，我冇騷擾你，得唔得啊？ 你有咩事發生啊？你即係你想點先？唔係，我就想同你解決。未解決咗就係咁。未解決。解決咗。未解決。大家即係解決咗佢啦。簡單，你講電話，我冇話你。你話我乜嘢先？大聲騷擾人。喂，你都講電話，我又冇話你大聲騷擾老人啊。大家都係講電話啫。 講電話一定有聲，但係你咧把聲咧，大家都係一樣噶啦。係啊，我有冇話你啊？點啊你？你好打咩？你屌你老母！你唔好打先。我有壓力，你有壓力，你做咩挑引我啊？唔好意思咯。真係唔好意思啊，道歉啦。
大声啲！大家注意，嗱，以后唔好话，警告你啊！攞手嚟啊！唔需要即系点啊？唔妥啊！你道歉咗咪揸手咯、啊？道歉唔揸手做咩啊？做咩唔需要啊？唔揸手即系未掂，唔揸手即系未掂啊！
未掂咁即係搞到掂乜嘢係嘛？我講電話你騷擾我，你講電話我有冇騷擾你啊？屌我已經拍我啦！我頭先我你要拍我膊頭做乜撚嘢？屌你老母！Okay, so I'm just gonna let that play as I speak. So this video, which was filmed a year and a half ago, inspired much debate over urban life in Hong Kong. And intriguingly, it's about an interactive situation, people overhearing each other's cell phone conversations in a bus, talking about digital interactivity a little differently. This was more popular than any film released in Hong Kong during this period. And the bus uncle's phrases were made into T-shirts, I've pressure, you've pressure. And apparently they were also reiterated during student exams. Someone wouldn't hand in their paper because I've stress. And it started a really interesting dialogue about the stresses of urban living, but it also became famous because it intersected with TV and other more mainstream forms of communication. And indeed, TV reporters tried to set up another meeting between these two people. And so I can't discuss this today, but you have a really interesting interweaving of new and old media. So you have a spread of new media through old media, which is then taken up once again in new media. In other words, you have an interesting interaction between these so-called separate media. Now, according to the cameraman, he made this video in case there was a fight, and he needed evidence for the police. Right? So this vehicle for publicity, this engaging of public issues, this exposing of private moments to the glare of publicity also seems to be an alibi for ever-present surveillance, right? A world in which there is, perhaps ominously, no darkness. And this question of control and freedom, however, does not just happen at the level of content, but also, and perhaps more importantly, at the level of technology itself, at the way the technology itself operates. And importantly, though, this control technology actually calls into question this binary separation of control from freedom, this reduction of freedom to control, this division of intrusion and interactivity. And to make this point, sorry, we're going to stop here. Let me turn to my packet sniffer. Okay. So for all of you unfamiliar with packet sniffers, they're software programs that analyze local area network traffic. Although they're used by artists and hackers and the FBI, they were developed by SysOps to develop networks that are always failing. And right now, what you see going back and forth are all the packets sent to and sent by my computer. Now, some of you may think that your interface controls your computer's action. That interactivity means that your computer sort of patiently waits for you to do an action and then it does something in return. As you can see, however, your computer is constantly wandering without you. I'm not doing anything, yet these packets are being sent back and forth all the time. Packets which in most cases just say, "Can you read me?" But importantly, these packets are anything but transparent to you, the user. Not only do you need a packet sniffer in order to be able to see this traffic, you also must have to translate them from the hexadecimal. Screening this traffic and making analogous browsing the web and reading a page makes us vulnerable, importantly, to back orifice attacks and focuses attention on the text and images pulsating from the screen rather than the ways in which we too are coded and circulated. Coded and circulated numerically, invisibly, non-volitionally. So what I argue in my book then is that the internet circulates our reproductions without our consent and knowledge by literalizing control, right? So etymologically, the English term control is based on the French contre-rule, a copy of a role of an account, etc., of the same quality and content of the original. And I stress that this literalization of control, doubled by the internet as transmission control protocol, internet protocol, is absolutely essential, right? So without this control, there would be no communications. There would be no internet. The problem lies not with the existence of control technologies which assume the fallible network. Rather, the problem lies precisely in the ways this interaction is covered over. Is covered over, hidden, and amplified, and imagined in ways that defy our very experience with our technologies. So in other words, the problem lies with the ways in which our interface is rendered into a mirror, and indeed a one-way mirror, where we think that we're just seeing ourselves, but everyone can see us, rather than dealing with the specificities and the complexities of a two-way mirror. So in terms of this experience and talking about surveillance networks, I'm always surprised by the number of people whose computers crash on a regular basis. The number of people who can't read older files because of software incompatibilities, or like me, who's suffering from early Alzheimer's, just has forgotten all the names of her files. I'm surprised by the number of these people honestly believe in a worldwide surveillance network in which no piece of data is ever lost. If there is such a worldwide surveillance network, it's not due to the inherentness of control technologies, but rather because it's an inherent to a logic that conflates memory with storage. And the new book I'm working on now actually interrogates this conflation of memory with storage. Now, importantly, though, I could easily put this sniffer in promiscuous mode. Oh, you are in promiscuous mode. No wonder you're going so crazy. So now you'll see it not in promiscuous mode. And what you were seeing actually was everybody's wireless interactions. But importantly, what promiscuous mode does is it doesn't alter the network card's normal interaction. So in other words, your cards read in all data and then actively erase what's not directly addressed to it. So the questions that immediately come to mind are, how is it that such a compromising and compromised form of communication has been bought and sold as empowering? Also, given that networked computers engage in an incessant and non-volitional exchange of information, why do we believe interactivity to be a form of mastery and freedom? Or the obverse, and importantly, not the opposite question, why do we imagine the internet to be a realm of total control? What are the differences, in other words, between technological and social control? And my first book was dedicated to these questions, and it looked at the ways in which freedom, especially in terms of this discourse of the internet is inherently freeing, has been reduced more and more to control, to paranoid narratives of the web and paranoid narratives of computers, and how these paranoid narratives seek to make the computer a one-way device. So a secure device that one sees through rather than through which one is seen. And I argue that not only is this impossible, it's dangerous. Because it's dangerous in the sense that once we start covering over what is really interactivity, once we start making the window dark, we're not able to see the ways in which others are constantly can see us. We don't understand the full implications of interactivity, and as well, we don't really address the ways in which the internet can be democratic. Democratic not because it allows us to control our actions, but also because it opens up the possibility of interactions that are beyond our immediate control. Now, a lot of the fears over the dangers of the internet or the internet's intrusiveness have focused on questions of pornography, sex, and sexuality. And that brings me to part two, pornographic intrusion. And what I want to suggest is that the anxieties expressed about sex and sexuality over the internet are actually productive. And they're productive points from which we can start discussing the internet as an intrusive and fundamentally open form of communication. Okay, so from all levels, from hardware to software, from interface to metaphor, sex and sexuality dominate our understandings of connectivity. In terms of hardware, male-to-female connectors figure all electronic information exchange as electrifying heterosexual intercourse. And here you see a humorous ad made by a Brazilian internet company. But I remember, so when I was working as an engineer, you know, everyone talked male-to-female connectors, and I was just realizing all my computers around me are configured as having heterosexual intercourse. So in terms of software, computer viruses allegedly spread like sexually transmitted diseases, contaminating and reproducing uncontrollably. Right? In Unix, you finger someone to see if they're connected, and our sniffers run promiscuously. In terms of content, pornography supposedly saturates the digital landscape, and flirting is endemic to all social networks. In terms of technology development, pornography is supposedly the killer application that convinces customers to invest in new hardware. That is, sexuality serves as the linchpin for strategies as diverse as entrepreneurial capitalism, censorship, and surveillance. Cyberporn indeed fueled, you can argue, the dot-com praise, right? So the first websites that were commercial were pornography sites. And apparently the fact that people were willing to send their credit card numbers online to porn sites of all sites convinced a lot of mainstream businesses that people were willing to send their credit cards, period, over the internet. In terms of censorship and surveillance, sexuality encapsulated and sequestered the risk of being online. So pre-9/11, and 9/11 has changed things in the US, almost all cases to censor the internet were made in the name of children who must be protected from the seamier sides of sexuality. So what's intriguing then is that through discussions of pornography, questions of vulnerability, questions of the internet as allowing intrusion were also addressed, right? Albeit in terms of those children who need to be protected, albeit in terms that sought to divide good and bad content. Now, let's think this through a little. When the internet went public by being sold to private corporations in the 1990s, it was not at all clear that the internet would take off, right? So remember the good old days, Gopher. It was mainly used in academia and military. And keep in mind that a good deal of fiber optic cable was laid in the 70s and 80s for video phones that never took off, right? Also, at the end of the 80s, you're talking about the Cold War. You're talking about Chernobyl. The liberal position was arguably anti-technology. So the fact that the internet emerged as a technology of empowerment, that technology once became good, is really fascinating. But recall again, 1995, sending one's credit card over the internet was considered an invitation to identity theft, right? The terror of the net, where one could be murdered because of this. Magazines like Vogue ran articles about cyberstalking. And lawmakers and journalists alike discovered what could not even count as an open secret amongst my engineering student peers, pornography on computer networks. And indeed, interestingly, in 1995, the year the U.S. legislature deregulated the communications industry, sold off the internet backbone, was also the year that it passed for the first time regulation over content, right? And this pornography panic is arguably still with us today, and it has perhaps forever linked the internet with child pornographers. But at the same time, the internet could have been linked to the increased tracking or the solution to child pornographers, right? It could have been sold as now these people who before were just exchanging pornography without any sort of tracking now can be caught, right? That is, if the internet had not already been sold as anonymous and empowering. So this image is taken from Time's 1995 cyber porn issue. Very different image than the one that we saw more recently. And it was used as evidence in the U.S. congressional debate over the Communications Decency Act. There were huge debates over this article both on and offline. And although the article itself rests with the banal suggestion that parents should discipline their children at home so that the internet can remain free, these really fascinating illustrations reveal the inadequacy of this neat separation. All right, so this cover image enacts first contact. Right? The glare of the computer screen, in contrast to the darkened room, simultaneously lights up and casts shadows over the startled blonde boy's face, sort of literalizing his enlightenment and overexposure. Right? His eyes and mouth are wide open, and his tiny hands are lifted off the computer screen in horror or in surprise. The images emanating from his monitor open and immobilize his facial orifices. And the screen's glare exposes wrinkles under the little boy's eyes that signal a premature aging, a loss of innocence that belies his tiny hands and his little two front teeth. And he's alone in front of the computer screen, and the room's dim lighting suggests secrecy. So instead of basking in the cozy light of the family home, he's immobilized by us watching him, since we, the readers, are actually in the position of the intruding pornographic image. Either that or he serves as our mirror image. Now, this image suggests that surprise and invasion only stems from pornography. But as I hope my packet-sniffing example has made clear, if the internet is pornographic, if the internet is intrusive, it's not because of its content, but rather its mode of communication, the control technologies on which it lies. The danger and the hope stem from the fact that the internet functions as a two-way viewing device. Now, this fear of the two-way is made most clear in the illustration on the table of contents page. So although the caption there reads, people are looking at pictures of what on the internet, an eye peers from the monitor to the viewer. The open monitor places Times Reader in the position of the viewer, suggesting that everyone in front of the computer is at risk. And once more, the screen offers the only source of light. And the computer screen becomes a window through which this other looks at and exposes us. So rather than an interface, you have this interesting and it's deemed pornographic moment of intraface. Right? The monitor monitors someone could be looking. To be clear, this is not an endorsement of pornographic websites. Although pornographic websites, and I'll have to conclude with this, are really intriguing for the ways they reveal the intertwining of control and freedom, that's a compensatory gesture. And porn in general reveals an interesting paradox, right? Pornography is supposed to be the most objectifying thing one can do, reduces one another to an object, but at the same time, it only works if one loses control over one's body. Right, but in terms of online porn, it seems to be less fascinating, less visual, less demanding, because it allegedly sits there on your screen for hours, sort of waiting for you to look at it. However, porn sites notoriously rewrite basic functions of your web browsers, revealing the ways in which a user choice is a software demonstration. So they often rewrite the back function so that you can't leave. So something has just happened to my little porn example. I didn't want to really show you porn, so I made this little JavaScript, which was working earlier. But again, it's the failures of technology, which are so fascinating. There we are. Look, more porn. You can't leave. It comes like, over and over and over again. Web brings. You're caught. And they also take advantage of the fact, especially on Windows machines, they can offer you a listing of your C drive, right? So people see it and they think, everyone can see what's on my hard drive, where it's actually just a function that's available through DOS. So the content and structure of pornography sites expose the tension between freedom and control that underlies the internet as a new mass medium. And publicity, I want to end by suggesting, is an enabling violation. Publicity is an enabling violation that stems from the breach between seeing and being seen. And the internet is public if it is because it allows people to speak in a space that is fundamentally indeterminate and pornographic. And here I offer you a quote from Thomas Keenan, which I won't go through. But in that sense, we are all that child, vulnerable to the other and not yet a discrete private individual. And this position can be terrifying, yet without this, we would have no democracy. And resisting this vulnerability leads to a twinning of control and freedom, a twinning that depends on the conflation of information with knowledge and democracy with security. So to seize the democratic potential of fiber optic networks, we must reject current understandings of freedom that make it into a gated community writ large, that reduce freedom to the freedom of a commodity within a marketplace. We must take seriously the vulnerability that comes with communications, not so that we simply condemn all vulnerability or accept it all, but so we can work together to create vulnerable systems with which we can live. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Wendy. It's always very inspiring to hear your talks. Maybe to start with, just to know if we got that right. So you had these two paths, control and freedom, voyeurism or exhibitionism, and you would say that this is like two sides of a medal, and you can't have the one without the other. So you can't have control without freedom, and you can't have voyeurism without exhibitionism?
Yes and no. So definitely that the way that the way control and freedom are set up right now, they are definitely the obverse of each other. But maybe if we consider freedom to be something not that emerges from control, but from which control can emerge, that we can have another understanding that doesn't reduce the two to the same thing.
So, and this is also the notion of vulnerability that is somehow in between the two terms, maybe?
Yes.
And would you say that this is, well, what is the special form of vulnerability within media? So, you know, it's like comparing it to,
right.
to non-mediated communication. So is it the intrusion of privacy, maybe, or is it the anonymity that makes it special?
I would say that this question of what is specific to vulnerability actually varies from medium to medium. I don't think that one can make a blanket statement. Broadcast television, for instance, is very different in terms of its modes of interactivity than cable television, which is different from the internet. And its modes of sort of sending back and forth, the constant sending back and forth. So I would say that in order to understand that, what we need to do is look at the interweaving of the technological with the interface, with the cultural, and the various ways in which these different layers do and don't speak to each other.
And so connecting to what you were saying about the TCP/IP protocol, which would be the special technology of the computer.
Of the internet.
Of the internet in this relation. Just to get that right, you mean that the protocol is always controlling which packets arrive and which ones don't arrive, and so that's the special technology that enables intrusion but also prevents it in a way, because there are like firewalls opt on this. TCP/IP protocol, I think, are?
Yes, yeah. Mm. So the firewalls aren't actually part of the TCP/IP protocol. So control technologies basically work on the idea of feedback, right? So there's the whole long tradition of it coming from cybernetics, Norbert Wiener's idea of control systems as enabling negative feedback. But the point about the internet and this sort of control technology is that it's always running. It's a continuous back and forth of packets that we don't normally see. And so my question is, how are these packets framed? And how do we understand this framing in terms of these notions of interactivity?
I want to come back to what you discussed in the second part, the pornographic intrusion, but I think it might also refer back to the first part. And if I got you right, you said something like, I say it in my words, that the internet is pornographic by nature or in principle is because there is something in the construction of the medium which makes it that way. Mm-hmm. Is that gonna get that right in a way?
Yeah, there I was going from a specific definition of pornography from Judith Butler, which I didn't show, which is the idea of pornography is that which circulates without one's consent but not for that reason against it.
Yeah. But I think there are various ways of pornography. That's why I wanted to add on that. Or let's first say what is not pornography is real sex, and real sex is maybe the most intense form of interhuman interaction. That's what makes it so thrilling. And pornography is the non-interactive part of sensuality, of just looking without really doing it, in a very simplified definition. But I think there are things in between which have been more popular in the 90s. There was all these ideas about cybersex, about interfaces, about touching remotely and all that.
And they were not always meant pornographically. They were meant as a commodity for couples who live apart, but also for having cyber sex to sell. And I mean, there were all these fantasies about that, and there are old fantasies from the 19th century of the virtual body. And still, I think today, it is even more than just looking at images, which has been there since photography and film in pornography, but it's various levels of possible interaction. You have these webcam things where you can tell the girl what she has to do, or you have chat rooms where you talk to somebody whom you don't know what it is, but you can fantasize about it. So there is something in between real sex and pornography, which is the totally non-interactive part. There are various levels of possible in-betweens, which can lead to the aim of real sexuality, of meeting in the flesh or not, you know. So I would be interested in your theory about that.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. The way I was talking about pornographic intrusion there was specifically in terms of the cyber porn debate, in which what was the ways in which people talked about what was bad interaction, that which intruded, was pornography, as if everything else could be controlled, right? So the internet would be good if you could just get rid of this bad content which somehow intruded. So I was looking at that, but I would also disagree with the notion that pornography is not interactive. In the sense that, especially, this partly comes from one of my friends, Richard, oh God, I am really going through Alzheimer's. I've forgotten everyone's name.
Later on,
18th century, who works on 18th century Enlightenment and pornographic texts, and the idea of being within the library. And the sort of interactions which are involved there, and the idea of bodily interaction in ways with text. So I think there are questions of interaction that pornography bring up in that way, and I would completely agree that there are, you know, various ways in which cybersex or different levels have been discussed. I'm not like, you know, Virilio's position is very extreme, right, where the cybersex is a form of, like the end of all future generations. No one will copulate, right? You know, ta-da, where the humankind is gonna die. But I think that, so this is a different question, which is a fascinating question, because all pornography isn't the same as well. You know, there are different types of pornography directed at different types of people, and there is also more and more quote-unquote amateur porn. And not in the faked sense of the 90s amateur porn, but really interesting sort of YouTube-like moments. So there I was simply talking about this idea that what is bad, you can get what is bad or intrusive out of the internet simply if you censor content.
Maybe to expand also a little bit in the history of various media forms, I had in the early 90s the idea that internet porn would be something that might go away, because I experienced that with video before, because the early 80s or late 70s, video was like the porn medium, and when you had a video recorder, you were suspicious of watching porn just for having that machine, you know. And the same was with Super 8 film in the early times. So as soon as it was a medium that could be handled privately, the idea was that you would use it for something that nobody else should see. But what is interesting is that this kind of adolescent stage never ended with the internet, but it became even stronger, or it is a parallel continuous track, and that differentiated from the other media. The other media still have their porn history, you still have porn DVDs and all that stuff, but they're not identified by it so strong, you know.
No, what I think is interesting is that the internet is changing precisely the notion of what should be private and what should be public. You see this all the time in political debates on things that have been placed on YouTube. You see these in questions of quote-unquote rumors. You see this with happy slapping and people putting up videos. You saw it more recently in the U.S. with the video of the cheerleaders just beating someone up and taping it because they wanted to put it on YouTube. Right. I mean, so I think that there's this larger issue of this question of the public and the private, which has been encapsulated in pornography, but it goes to larger questions of what is quote unquote appropriate.
Yeah. So this was a private conversation, maybe.
Yes.
Made it more public.
Anybody in the audience who would like to comment or pick up another point on when?
Thank you for your talk. It was very good. I appreciate that.
You mentioned earlier in your talk about Twitter and about the idea of the exhibitionism and voyeurism. And in a way, the way I paraphrase that, it sounds to me like the idea of microfame, for example, is kind of a new pornography for people and for themselves and for other people. I want to know, what are your thoughts on the ability for someone to become microfamous or tell you what's happening in their life every single minute of the day? And sometimes that might be inappropriate content. What is your take on this trend?
That's a great question, and links to the question before of the public and private and what's quote-unquote appropriate. What I also find about fascinating about the internet is that what we find are more and more people wanting to be tracked. There's a certain desire to be seen, to be known. I mean, Jody Dean has written a fantastic book. See, I remembered a name. Publicity Secret, in which she talks about the intertwining of publicity and democracy. But a lot of people have talked about this desire to be tracked, this desire to be seen. Ursula Frone has argued now to be seen, how does she put it? To be is to be seen. And certainly now, but I would argue that it's not just seeing, because that's placing too much emphasis on the visual. And what the internet and TCPIP do as well is create this fascinating non-visual web of communication, this non-visual desire to be tracked and track. And I think this whole question opens up in really intriguing ways the question of democracy and of participation. You know, is this in some way, quote unquote, democratic? Or how does this open questions of desire to be counted in other ways than counting normally goes? And is it empowering, or is it, again, just a way of letting everybody know your own preferences, right? So Facebook now is talking about doing ads in which they go through your wall, right, and say, you say, I bought a great sweater at Macy's. Ta-da, a Macy's ad right next to your posting. So I think these questions of tracking and being tracked and desire are really intriguing ones.
Thanks. I'll just continue the same train of thought. Back to this thing of private public. I think in your research you've probably come across a lot of interesting projects that perhaps make the internet more like a window and less like a mirror that's one way. Perhaps you could mention a few examples?
No, there's some great artwork that does this. RSG Carnivore, of course, is one that immediately comes to mind. But again, it's sort of focused on questions of visualizations. There's some fantastic surveillance work that incorporates surveillance, ones that are both on the web and sort of everyday, but also some really fascinating installations. What I find really interesting about a lot of the new installations is that rather than just showing some sort of mapping, like monkey, you do this, the artwork does this, it actually troubles this mapping in really intriguing ways, has the trace do something else. And so again, this is, I think, we're moving beyond the stage of just making visible what's invisible, but reworking the invisible, and therefore impacting the visible in really interesting ways.
Okay, I think we have to stop at this point. Thank you very much again, Wendy, and thank you also the two of you. I think that was a very...